So good evening again. And tonight's topic is sadha, or confidence in practice. I'm going to discuss how our insight meditation tradition talks about this quality, why it's important for our practice, and some ways we might cultivate it. And at the outset, I want to highlight that the tradition talks about faith and belief in quite a variety of ways. So I'm going to focus on some of the pieces that have traction in my own experience. And tonight's discussion is not intended as a panoramic view of the subject. And by way of introduction, I also want to say that I am really energized by this quality of sadha, in part because my mind sometimes tilts quite strongly toward doubt and aversion, and really can have an ambivalent relationship with faith traditions. So anyone else fit this description? I thought I might not be alone. Are folks familiar with the word sadha?
No.
Okay. So we'll start at the very beginning then. It's a Pali word. Pali is the ancient language in which a lot of the Theravadin texts, or the texts that are the basis of this particular practice tradition, were written. And the word sadha is often translated as faith, but that translation, even though it's absolutely accurate, really can have hooks for many people. You know, maybe associations with top-down religious beliefs and doctrines, among other things. So it's really important to understand that in Buddhist practice, sadha is part of an experiential and investigational path of practice. It's not only, and it's not primarily, about belief. So let's unpack the word sadha a little bit more. In addition to faith, among other translations, it's been interpreted as trust, confidence, and to place the heart upon. And I think you can readily see that all of these words describe qualities of emotion or heart. They're closely connected with love or even devotion. And Sharon Salzberg, a contemporary Buddhist teacher whom I think many of you are familiar with, says that sadha is a verb, and translating it into English, that we faith, or faith. So in Buddhist and Theravadin tradition, sadha is an important capacity or faculty that we actually can cultivate, and it's an important support for spiritual practice. It's actually the first of the five spiritual faculties that support us in the path of practice. So are folks familiar with the five spiritual faculties? A show of hands. Okay, so you know about half. So just to summarize very briefly, the first spiritual faculty is sadha, the quality that we're going to be discussing over the course of this evening. Virya, or energy or persistence. Then sati, which is generally translated as mindfulness or awareness. Samadhi, or concentration, also translated as steadiness, collectedness of mind. And panya, or wisdom. And the teaching is that each of these five qualities supports the growth of the next. So our initial faith or confidence impels us to apply ourselves in practice. This cultivates mindfulness, and in turn cultivate steadiness of mind, collectedness, concentration. The concentration or the collectedness support the development of wisdom, which is the fifth of the spiritual faculties. And then the experience of wisdom that results from our practice leads back to a more secure form of sadha, the original quality of faith, and so forth. It goes on and on, hopefully in an endlessly strengthening loop. So even from this very brief summary of the five spiritual faculties, I think it's clear that this is a gradual and progressive and experiential process in which faith, really supports our willingness to make effort in our practice. And then the experiences and understandings that result from this continue to cultivate confidence and faith. So the Buddhist tradition, and certainly the Theravadan tradition, talks about three different types of faith: bright or borrowed faith, verified faith, and abiding or unwavering faith. And these are often discussed as successive stages, but I think it's also really useful to think of it as a continuum, not so much as totally separate kinds of experience. And even though it's a progressive process, the quality of faith that supports us as beginners, that bright or borrowed faith, may actually be something that we return to at any stage of practice. So let's look at each one. First, bright or borrowed faith. And this is a place where we really see the role of inspiration. Bright or borrowed faith is basically the initial inspiration to practice before we ourselves have experienced the fruit of practice. So perhaps we're inspired by the qualities of another person, a teacher, a practitioner, or maybe it's not another person. Maybe we read a book or we hear a Dharma discussion in a way that really resonates with us and impels us to start exploring the path for ourselves. And at this stage of bright or borrowed faith, we're jumping in because we're moved in some way, but we're really taking on faith that this, quite literally, that this practice is worth trying before we've had the opportunity to know for ourselves. So bright or borrowed faith is sometimes analogized to falling in love, but remember that people fall in love in different ways and to different degrees. And for some people, it might be more like falling in like. And these could all be very legitimate, very useful experiences of bright or borrowed faith. So just a couple of examples of this type of faith from my own practice. So when I came here 11 years ago, I experienced a very strong resonance with the teachings that I heard in this room, especially the way ethical practice and mind training support each other. And this was enough to give me an intuitive confidence that the practice was going to be a lifelong commitment. And just you can hear just from this description, this is a fairly quiet, understated experience. You know, it definitely was of the falling in like variety. But looking back, I really recognize it as a form of bright faith. I wouldn't have used the term at the time because I had never heard it. So fast forward to an experience of borrowed faith quite a few years into practice. So just at a time when I was experiencing quite a bit of doubt about my own practice, I heard a teacher that I respect talk about her own story, including just painfully aversive patterns of mind that drove her to practice, some of the ways she cultivated awareness of these patterns through practice, and also how practice contributed palpably to weakening the grip and the intensity of these patterns for her. And I already had an experience of this teacher's integrity, clarity, kindness. So hearing about her journey, just hearing about where she had started, and knowing where she had gone on to, really reinfused me with considerable confidence about the transformation that's possible through practice. And I'm throwing out the second example particularly because it illustrates how bright or borrowed faith is not just something we draw on at the beginning of practice. We can need that infusion. We can need to borrow someone else's example, experience, our own excitement about what another person has been able to accomplish at many different points along the journey. So the second type of faith that the tradition talks about is often called verified faith, and this is where we begin to see the role of experience. So as we practice, we begin to experience fruits of practice for ourselves, and this reinforces confidence in practice, sadha, as well as our commitment to keep practicing. And especially in the early years of practice, it's important to acknowledge that these fruits can be really subtle. And we might not even notice the fruits of practice if we're not paying attention. You know, we sometimes have ideas about how practice should look. You know, we might think that if the practice is working, then the changes in our lives and our personalities should be much more dramatic and obvious than they are, or more lasting. Has anyone ever had that sort of feeling? Yeah, I certainly have. Yet the truth is that probably everyone who's here who's practiced for any amount of time, and looking around the room at people I know there are people who have been doing this for years and people who are quite new to the practice, so I'm really including everyone in this description. You know, anyone who's practiced for any amount of time actually probably has experienced some wholesome effects. If we've experienced wholesome effects on our minds and hearts, those are fruits of practice. And more specifically, we've probably experienced some shifts in our relationship to clinging and to the suffering that clinging causes. And of course, that's what we're talking about in this practice. That's such a focus within this practice. So the benefits that we've experienced at this point might be dramatic and long-lasting, but they also might be very fleeting. You know, maybe it's one small thing that we refrained from saying or doing. Or maybe it's just like one tiny piece of our experience that we understand differently. I think it's particularly valuable and particularly important to recognize the small and humble examples of awareness at work, because certainly, at least in my experience, we get a lot more of those small and humble examples than we get fireworks. So I'll just offer one example of verified faith from my own experience. And this is somewhere in the middle. It's not a fleeting moment, but not a lasting character change, not anywhere near that. So when I've been doing this practice for quite a number of years, I was at work one day in a meeting, and I was stewing about whether my advice on a particular issue would be accepted. And just like take it on faith that it was really good advice. I was right. Whatever it was, I have no idea what it was a few years later. But there was a really intense and persistent experience of stress, emotional heat, energy, turbulence, rumination. I mean, I was really hooked. The mind just was spinning stories that led to more stories, that led to more emotional heat, that led to more stories. And I mean, I'm sure we've all been there at one point or another. I was definitely there. And at the end of the meeting, just as I left the meeting through the conference room door, I just had a recognition. This is identification with views. That's what came to me. This is identification with views. And in that moment, I actually saw the way the mind was clinging to views and creating the drama of a self who had these views and who was right about these views. And I actually also saw how this clinging was causing the very uncomfortable emotional churning, aka dukkha. And really just seeing that, there was some immediate relief and actually even a sense that this was pretty funny. And, you know, it's not that the churning disappeared, and it's not that, you know, my own tendency of mind to sometimes be attached or cling to views has now been uprooted. It's a few years later. It hasn't been uprooted. But as soon as I saw what was going on, there simply was less clinging and less suffering and really a good deal more spaciousness while the mind still, you know, was running through a few loops. And, you know, there also was a little burst of excitement at seeing the day-in, day-out practice I've been doing, the meditation practice, the attempts to be aware in everyday life, and the Dharma that I've been hearing come together for this one moment. And really, that burst of excitement, that sense that I had learned something and that I saw it in my own heart and saw, you know, just like a little moment of freedom, this really bolstered the value I placed on practice. So for me, this is a humble but a fairly powerful example of a verified faith in my life. So as I mentioned, the third form of faith that the tradition talks about is abiding or unwavering faith. And again, we can really see how this is a progressive process. So I can't speak about abiding or unwavering faith from my own personal experience. But the whole arc of this practice that culminates in unwavering faith is beautifully summarized in a passage I'm going to read from Sharon Salzberg's book, Faith. She says, "The offering of one's heart happens in stages, with shadings of hesitation and bursts of freedom. Faith evolves from the first intoxicating blush of bright faith to a faith that is verified through our doubting, questioning, and sincere effort to see the truth for ourselves. Bright faith steeps us in a sense of possibility. Verified faith confirms our ability to make that possibility real. Then, as we come to know the underlying truths of who we are and what our lives are about, abiding faith, or unwavering faith, as it is traditionally called, arises." So, since the path of practice that we're on is experiential, that is what this insight meditation tradition and practice is all about, it's important to know that all three of these qualities of faith or confidence, including bright faith, depend on our own experience and investigation. You may have heard the Pali word ehipasiko, which translates as come see for yourself. And the one-liner on this is that the Buddha, as he is portrayed in the suttas, did not tell people to accept his teachings blindly. You won't find that, I don't think, in the suttas. He did, at least again, as the suttas portray his life, invite people to put his teachings into practice and see the results for themselves. He wasn't neutral about which practices were beneficial, but he was very clear that the way we saw the benefits was to experience them, was to engage with the practice. So the question inevitably arises, what's the relationship of doubt to sadha? And first of all, I think it's really important to say that they're not opposites. Sadha does not require putting aside questions. You saw that reference to our questions and our hesitations in that beautiful passage by Sharon Salzberg. And sadha does not require an absence of doubt. Sadha is really about engaging with our experience moment after moment without any guarantee or certainty about where this will ultimately lead. So, I mean, I think it should actually be obvious that engaged, sincere questioning is not at odds with sadha because it's a form of engagement with practice and engagement with tradition. And also, very practically, questioning is a way of starting from our experience as it actually is, including our confusions and our questions. And the ability to start from where we are and to pay attention to where we are is actually an essential aspect of this practice. So it would be sort of ruinous if we couldn't have questions as part of the path of faith, or if we couldn't have doubts. At the same time, it is important, I think, to recognize the difference between engaged questioning and doubt as a hindrance. So is everyone familiar with the hindrances, the five hindrances?
Yeah.
Okay. So as a hindrance or as an unwholesome quality, doubt is paralyzing. You know, it fuels indecisiveness. That's part of what it does. Its role as a quality is to obscure and to make our vision unclear. And that is different from engaged questioning. But the good news is that even the unwholesome quality of doubt can be the ground of practice if we take it as an object of awareness and investigation, and if we continue practicing. And really, this is the case with all the hindrances. I mean, the tradition understands that we will encounter hindrances. There wouldn't be a big teaching on the hindrances if we didn't have hindrances, and if having hindrances was incompatible with gaining freedom. To the contrary, you know, as I said, the tradition really does understand that we will encounter hindrances and teaches that cultivating awareness of the hindrances without succumbing to them is part of the practice that actually leads us forward toward wisdom. So why is sadha such an important quality? You know, anyone want to volunteer a thought about that?
It's just on the path.
Yeah, exactly.
We're going to flounder.
We are, and we do. We do anyway, but we come back. Yeah, no, exactly. It's the juice. It's the motivation. And, you know, this is important because practice can be really difficult and really counterintuitive. And the phrase that is often used in the tradition is against the stream. So I'm actually going to read you a short passage from a website by a group that I think many of you are familiar with called Against the Stream. It's an extended sangha founded by Noah Levine in L.A. Against the Stream's website says, the Buddha says that his path to awakening was one of rebellion, a subversive path that is against greed, against hatred, and against delusion. In order to awaken, he taught that we have to travel against the norm of society and against our own self-centered tendencies. In his own language, he said the path he had traveled and that all who wished to follow was patisotagami, which literally translates as against the stream. And to elaborate on that, you know, I think that the thing that's difficult or can be difficult and counterintuitive about the practice is that our untrained minds, left to their own devices, pursue pleasure and avoid unpleasantness. Yet the liberation that this path offers requires us to cultivate awareness of experience as it actually is, which may be unpleasant. It's not only unpleasant, but if we're cultivating awareness of experience as it is, it includes the unpleasant. So, you know, we just plain need a lot of shoring up for this. And you know, yeah, that is the importance of sadha. So I'd like to just throw out some practical ways that we might cultivate sadha. And clearly it's kind of a menu of possibilities. It's not complete, and not everything on the menu will be for everyone. And actually, everything I'm going to suggest here is a way of showing up for our practice. Again, because practice is difficult and can be counterintuitive, especially when what's there to be aware of isn't pleasant. So Wayne Gretzky, who is a great hockey player, is famous for saying, you miss 100% of the shots you don't take. And, you know, I think very analogously, we can't reap the fruits of practice, which include insight about how the mind operates, if we don't show up to see the mind at work. It's that simple. So in practical terms, how might this look? I think one thing that can be invaluable is setting an expectation of a daily sitting practice. And, you know, whenever you say anything like daily, you know, you can always see the mental gears going in yourself or in other people saying, does that really mean every day? And I think the important thing is it's setting an expectation, and as that is, that really becomes a reference point. And we may see that we've dropped away. You know, that can happen to us human beings. But if we're setting the expectation, then if we see that we've dropped away, this can actually be a very fertile ground for exploration. You know, what's going on? What's going on in the mind? Is this a manifestation of doubt? Is this a manifestation of some resistance? You know, what's actually happening? If we don't set the expectation, we don't even get to ask ourselves that question. So this kind of exploration, though, using our falling away, if it happens, as an exploration, this will cultivate sadha more than beating ourselves up if we miss a day. And maintaining a regular practice, you know, just inherently means showing up even if there's doubt. So if we hold doubt as one more experience to be curious about, one more experience to be aware of, rather than something we need to believe or obey or something that we need to muscle down, then this actually puts us in a radically different relationship with doubt. And I'm saying doubt, but ditto for any difficult experience. If we sit down notwithstanding, if we allow ourselves to be curious about it. And the willingness to practice with doubt or with any difficult experience actually is a manifestation of faith. And I think something that can really also reinforce our faith. And the showing up ultimately is what dispels the doubt, because our cumulative experience with practice is what gives rise to the inner confidence or the sadha. Since I've mentioned doubt quite a bit, and I've mentioned that this is a tendency of mine that I am sometimes privileged to explore, I do want to throw out a caveat that, you know, doubt can be particularly difficult to investigate, because the character of doubt, again, is to confuse us, to obscure our vision. It's really closely related to delusion. I've personally found that investigating doubt, at least when it's heavy-duty doubt, is a place where asking a teacher for help and support can be really invaluable. I can't always see it by myself or for myself. So that all of that is really one idea about cultivating sadha, the showing up and holding our practice as a daily commitment. Also, showing up for Sangha. Many of us find that we really do need the support of a community to keep doing this. And a strong practice community, which I think we are really privileged to have here, helps us tremendously to swim against the stream of the prevailing culture. And, you know, I would say even in California, we're still swimming against the stream. And Sangha can be what we have here, our weekly group. It also can include affinity groups, Kalyanamitta groups, Dharma buddies, all of the different forms of spiritual friendship. Service to the Sangha, another faith-instilling activity. In purely practical terms, service to the Sangha is what keeps the Sangha going so that it's there for us. But also, and this is really why I'm raising it in this talk, our service also reinforces faith. It really reinforces faith to see ourselves nourishing the Dharma. That's more of a heartfelt or emotional experience. Taking longer opportunities to practice, such as day-longs and retreats. Working with the ethical precepts as a daily practice and a source of reflection. One that I particularly like is setting intentions and aspirations about our practice, around our practice. For example, there's a practice called the Three Excellences, which I think comes from the Tibetan tradition, but I've actually learned it on Vipassana retreats, where at the beginning of our practice, whether it's our sitting practice or any other practice, we start by articulating an aspiration, whether that is an aspiration that all beings might benefit from our practice, or a more concrete aspiration about how we want to work with the practice. May my heart open. May this practice cultivate continuity of awareness. Whatever is really meaningful to us, this is a very personal aspiration. The second excellence is that we do the practice, and the third is dedicating the merit. And for many people, and again, this happens to be one that speaks to my heart, framing the practice in this way really reinforces intention, and I also think can really reinforce confidence, connectedness with the practice. Taking the refuges, the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha. Our Sangha heard a talk about this just, I believe, 2 weeks ago. If you are of a mind to read as a way of understanding this quality of sadha better. I would really recommend Sharon Salzberg's book on faith. It's a real gem. It's short, it's accessible, it's personal, and it's really written to speak to those of us who don't resonate with perhaps a more traditional view of faith as belief, doctrine, toeing the line. She really does just a beautiful job of dispelling that's what faith is about, and of really talking in a lot of personal depth about this experiential path of practice that sadha is. And finally, I think just taking time periodically to reflect on the experiences we've already had that verify the value of practice. And again, as I mentioned just a little while ago, these can be subtle. They might seem slight. You know, maybe it's the one thing you didn't open your mouth and say, and all of the damage that didn't occur as a result. So actually, before we go on to some questions and group discussion, let's actually just take a moment to reflect individually on how we may have seen some fruit in practice, dramatic or subtle. And just, you know, maybe close your eyes if that's comfortable. There have been a lot of words in the room. Maybe let yourself just sit comfortably in the chair and be quiet for a moment. You may want to take a couple of deep breaths to settle back into yourself. And just allow the mind to know if you've had experiences that in any way let you know that there have been benefits of practice, fruits of practice. The mind doesn't have to have any answers. It's fine if nothing comes up. What comes up doesn't have to make sense in the moment. How have you been fed by practice? Have there been moments of liberation? Have there been little releases? Have there been understandings? What does your heart understand about practice? So let's gently return to the room. Take a moment to let yourself come back fully. And at this point, we actually have time for questions, reflections, anything you'd like to share. You might want to share something that came to you in the reflections we did now, where you've seen the fruits of practice for yourself. You might want to share places in your sitting practice or daily life practice where you've seen sadha at work or struggled with it, you know, or just any questions that you'd like to raise at this point.
A reflection I had
Well, I've been on a path of recovery for several years prior to coming to SIM, and so I'm really new to the Buddhist practice, but what I've found is a lot of the tools, spiritual tools that I had been given and learned are really in the same line, and so the wording, it's like I've come to the same understandings, but the verbiage is different. Like, for example, sadha, how you have the three stages. You know, when I first came into recovery and I was broken on all levels and so far down into suffering and confused, but I saw somebody else had hope, and then I got hope because I saw somebody practice some of these tools and principles and I had hope. So that was like the first stage, the bright one, so borrowed. And then I would start to practice and follow some of those and use some of those tools and this mindfulness and looking at my patterns of behavior, and then I'd see change. And then I got some faith that maybe this stuff really is real, you know. And then after a long period of practicing and applying it, I had belief, you know. And so that, in a sense, that's kind of like the three stages that you just, you know, talked about. So that was what I was paralleling. And I'm, you know, I'm getting deeper into practice now that I'm into this tradition. But it's really amazing how aligned a lot of the path that I've been on.
Thank you very much for laying that out so clearly. And also for flagging that, you know, obviously the words are important, but they're important as a way to point toward experience. And, you know, for example, when we're using Pali words, part of why we come up with so many English words in translation is that none of them are quite capturing the experience. Mm. But I think that resonance with the idea of how progressive and experiential the path is and how you start out before you can really know, and yet something pulls you along. Mm-hmm. And then your actual experiences get you deeper and deeper into an understanding that this is something you're willing to commit to. Mm-hmm. So, you know, thank you for that very much.
Laura, you had very clearly given an example of the first two progressive forms of faith, and I think you had said that I have not yet come to that place of abiding faith, and I just wondered if you could describe what it is that it, you think it is, and why you maybe don't think you have arrived there yet or have glimpsed that yet. I remember reading her book and it was glorious. It's a glorious book. It's a wonderful book. It's been a very, very long time. So I just wondered about the abiding faith a little bit more to talk about that.
You know, I feel somewhat of an obligation to stay in the tradition of really only describing what I can from my own experience and not what's speculative.
Sure.
And so really that's why I deliberately chose Sharon Salzberg's words. We probably have enough time for me to read a little more from one of the suttas that talks about that quality of having faith in the ancient Pali. Well, I'm not going to read the ancient Pali. So I have a little portion of the talk that says, don't read from Majjhima Nikaya 7. It was just a note to myself that I had this available, you know, should it be relevant. And I think I will share it. So this is a somewhat condensed with you know, some ellipses to avoid too much repetition. So this is a passage from Majjhima Nikaya 7, is one of it's the middle length discourses, the seventh discourse. The whole discourse is called the simile of the cloth. And you won't see the simile of the cloth in this particular portion, but simile of the cloth has to do with that a dirty cloth will not take up dye well, whereas a cleaned or purified cloth will, and that's analogized to the human mind and its ability to take up wisdom and ultimately insight and enlightenment. So that's already been expressed. And then these are the Buddha's words in the sutta, or as portrayed by the sutta. When in the monk who thus knows that covetousness and unrighteousness greed are a defilement of mind. So let me back up a second. The basic pattern you'll see is that by knowing, it's very much talking about the practice we're doing in this sutta, that by knowing that a particular mental pattern is destructive, is causing that suffering, that knowing, if we see it clearly enough, actually is what causes us to let go of that, and that in turn leads to our increasing faith. So just to say that that's what's posited here, so that it'll be a little more clear reading it. So when in the monk who knows that covetousness and unrighteous greed are a defilement of the mind, this covetousness and unrighteous greed have been abandoned, when in him who knows that ill will is a defilement of the mind, this ill will has been abandoned, when in him who knows that negligence is a defilement of the mind, this negligence has been abandoned, he thereupon gains unwavering confidence in the Buddha. He gains unwavering confidence in the Dharma thus. Well proclaimed by the Blessed One is the Dhamma, realizable here and now, possessed of immediate result, bidding you come and see, accessible and knowable individually by the wise. So essentially by the monk's own actions in seeing through his, or we would say her own, destructive patterns, that's a cause of abandoning the patterns. That elicits faith in the Buddha as a teacher. That in turn elicits confidence in the Dharma and the quality of teaching. And then the sutta goes on, he gains unwavering confidence in the Sangha thus. That's, in our lay terms, that's all of us sitting here. The Sangha of the Blessed One's disciples has entered on the good way, has entered on the straight way, has entered on the true way, has entered on the proper way. So in other words, by having that experience, it then reinforces confidence that our traveling companions on the path, along with us, are on a sound path. I don't think I want to read the whole thing, but it goes on in a similar vein, and then it culminates, this particular portion culminates. He abides, having suffused with a mind of loving kindness one direction of the world, likewise the second, likewise the third, likewise the fourth, and so above, below, around, and everywhere, and to all as to himself. He abides suffusing the entire universe with loving kindness, with a mind grown great, lofty, boundless, and free from enmity and ill will. He abides having suffused with a mind of compassion, of sympathetic joy, of equanimity, with a mind grown great, lofty, boundless, and free from enmity and ill will. He understands what exists, what is low, what is excellent, and what escape there is from this whole field of perception. When he knows and sees this way, his mind becomes liberated. So just to give, you've seen Sharon Salzberg's, you know, briefer and more contemporary description, but just to give a flavor of how this process of unwavering faith, which by the way brings in all of the Brahmaviharas, all of those qualities of heart that we've learned about, that gives you the flavor of how this was talked about in the ancient texts and how long it's been talked about. Any other questions, reflections?
One friend talked to me, he mentioned about he practiced meditation or practiced Dharma for several years. So the way he characterized the life, the challenging, there's three kind of challenging, low level challenging, medium level challenging, and high level challenging. Okay, the way he characterized life. He mentioned about after practice several years, he can handle a low level, a medium level very well in terms of his emotion, because he just mentioned before he start practicing the Dharma, his emotion were out of control, even face to the low level or medium level or challenging, but right now he's doing better. So he can handle low level or medium level very well. However, when facing the high level challenge, it's still out of control. So he mentioned to me, he don't know where he is. When facing the low level or medium level, he feels he's in the unbearable stage. When facing to the high level challenge, he kind of got back to the stage one.
Yeah.
So he don't know where you are because I don't know how to provide a comment to him, so I just provide what he said to me. So maybe you can provide some comments.
You know, I would be hesitant first to try to say something that I could guess would be helpful for him specifically, but I guess a couple of things come to mind right away. One is that he seems that arc of practice where making efforts does yield results, and yet we really do see that there are parts of our minds that are unrepentant. That's really a shared experience. So, I mean, one reflection is that he has had some experience with sorrow. I, of course, can't suggest how to talk to this individual because, you know, you obviously do know him well and have, you know, his confidence. But it does strike me that someone who has recognized already a level of progress and a level of fruit, a level of alleviation of suffering, that's worth reflecting on, that is faith-inducing. The other thing I would say is that it can be really hard, and sometimes because we start seeing maybe some of the more superficial levels of suffering or of self-delusion fall away, we can sometimes set ourselves up to expect that we're further along than we are. And sometimes, you know, sometimes because we start paying more attention, we can also see, you know, sometimes more clearly and painfully how flawed the mind is. I think it's one of the reasons, just for me as a practitioner, why I think it's so important to have the support and the comfort of Sangha, because it is just that hard. You know, for me as a practitioner, it's also why over time I have found it important to work one-on-one with a teacher. And there are different ways of doing that, of course. In this community, we have community mentors, people, a number of us, you know, have worked with teachers that we've come to know, whether it's here or through retreat work. But we can't always steer the path ourselves, or even just, you know, with the help of our Dharma friends. And sometimes a teacher or a wise mentor, you know, who knows practice well enough to really engage about what a person is doing, can make the difference between just floundering painfully and having some additional handles or skills for sitting with or understanding the painful experiences in a way that leads back to the path of practice and kind of reinforces faith. So I don't know if any of that's helpful, but those are at least the things that come to mind, you know, for me as just, you know, as one practitioner.
Thank you.
You're welcome, thank you. I think we have time for maybe one or two comments or questions before we wrap up.
I've noticed that when I have been on retreats, silent retreats, and you hear a Dharma talk and you meditate and everything, I mean, you can have some painful things come up, but overall you're in a very protected environment and, you know, I feel safe, I feel peaceful, I feel loving, like I have no, you know, ill will towards anybody at the retreat. And then it's like when I go back to my work environment, I am super sensitive and nastier than before I went on the retreat. And that is like I mean, I see it now, and so I'm much more, you know, aware that I have to be noble silence at work. But it's really surprising because I thought I would be more open-hearted, but I see that these are a totally different group of people, and they operate on a totally different level. And I think that I come back from a retreat thinking that I'm around my Sangha friends. And I mean, I have just beat myself up in the past at how could I say that? How could I think that? But I do. I mean, I do think that, and I feel that way, you know, and I notice that. And so I don't know exactly how that has to do with faith, but that's something I just noticed about going on a retreat and then coming back into my everyday work world. It's humbling.
It is humbling.
It is.
And I actually have a follow-up question because you're describing that rawness, and I think, you know, there is sometimes just a rawness coming out of retreat. Things are still at work in us. So maybe we were protected, but, you know, we're not always fully grounded. We haven't fully integrated that. But I hear the rawness. I mean, it's something that I am familiar with. But I'm also hearing something else that would be really helpful, I think, to elaborate a little more, which is it also sounded like you were describing sort of an arc of understanding where early in your retreat life you were saying those things that were unskillful and feeling badly about it and beating yourself up and feeling that you'd misgauged the situation. And that's not what's happening now. And so I'm wondering if you could say a little bit more about that.
It's not happening now that much. I can't say that I've totally, you know, gotten over that. In fact, just the other day I actually made an unskillful comment that was hurtful, you know. But I am, if anything, much more forgiving of myself for just being human. And sometimes, you know, it's best to be quiet, but it isn't always like that for me. But I do see it, and I definitely have seen growth in my ability to zip it.
And it actually sounds like, yeah, no, and actually I'm hearing just in what you're saying, and just in this brief conversation, I'm actually hearing you describe two forms of growth from practice. One is, you know, a decreased tendency to open your mouth, you know, which I mean, we all do, but mm-hmm. an increased ability to kind of guard against that, the form of wisdom, form of understanding of consequences, which is one aspect of wisdom, and that's what our practice is about. And the other piece that I'm hearing as an evolution or a growth, at least the way you're describing it, is also when you do fall down, more of an understanding that you're human, but the self-forgiveness, which again is it's a quality that's closely related to metta and to compassion. And so, you know, I can only speak for myself and you know, not want to impose on your experience, but it sounds, just hearing you describe that there's already an arc of practice that you're aware of and that you're giving yourself credit for. And I think that is kind of what we're talking about when we start talking about verified faith. And the verified faith does not necessarily mean like the day I woke up fully enlightened. I mean, that was such an incredible day that I've totally forgotten about. but we have these moments where, oh yeah, I didn't say that thing, or I said it, but then I came back to self-love much faster. So I think that's exactly what verified faith is about. So let's just close by dedicating the merit of a little metta prayer. So after all of our sharing and conversation and reflection, let's just let ourselves be comfortable and quiet again. Do anything we need to do to just be comfortable for this last minute or so in our chairs. May any merit that's arisen from our practice here together tonight truly feed our confidence in our own practice, our willingness to continue on this path and support one another in our practice. May that be of benefit to all sentient beings. May all beings be safe from inner and outer harm. May all beings be happy. May all beings be healthy and strong. May all beings be able to care for themselves with ease. And may all beings be free from suffering and the causes of suffering. Thank you very much for your attention and your participation in your practice.